1824 Sierra State v. Perkins. Mr. Schmall, Assistant State Public Defender. It's your turn.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is William Schmall. I'm an Assistant State Public Defender, Appellate Division, and I represent Merle Perkins. By way of introduction, this is a criminal case, and the crime in question is a matter of first impression in Wisconsin law, namely threatening a judge. In this particular case, it arises in the context of an act of pure speech. Therefore, I would urge the court to exercise caution in approaching it. I anticipate many questions by the court this afternoon, and therefore I would simply outline at the beginning the three or four categories that I will address if time permits. First of all, I will review the definition of a true threat under the First Amendment. That really isn't in dispute by the parties, and it wasn't really in dispute in the Court of Appeals, but I think it's a good starting place. Second, I will discuss why the outcome in this case, in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence to support conviction, should not be any different than it was in the United States Supreme Court case, Watts versus United States. Third, I will address why the Wisconsin pattern jury instruction, which defines the offense of threatening a judge, is deficient. That is an issue that is in dispute by the parties. And lastly, if there is enough time, I will briefly discuss the ineffective assistance issue, which focuses upon the element of whether there was prejudice in this case. So then, beginning, as I say, with the definition of a threat under this statute, threat to a judge. The first thing we can note is that the term threat is not defined in the statute defining this crime. And under normal appellate practice, and indeed section 990.01 of the statutes, indicates to us that then what we should do is apply the common and ordinary usage of the term if it's not defined in the statute. And unless the term is a technical word, in which case the courts would determine a different meaning for it. Now, I think the Attorney General and I are in agreement, basically, that the common and ordinary definition of a threat that can be obtained from any dictionary is something as follows: an expression of intent to harm another person by unlawful means. But my fundamental argument is that if we utilize that common and ordinary meaning of the term threat, it would sweep too broadly under the First Amendment. It would, in effect, proscribe some types of speech which are protected under a constitution.
Let me ask you, counsel, and I know I hate to interrupt, but I want to ask, are you going to add what else you think the state should have had here? Is this where you're going as far as what you think a threat should be? Because I'm just looking at this case from A, here was a threat. I mean, strike that, here was speech. Then you add a gun to it, which in Watts you had, I'm going to shoot somebody, but the gun wasn't there. Here the gun was there, and then you add to it that someone heard a gunshot, could have been a firecracker, and that your client then said, I did shoot the gun. So what else are you going to add to the threat? That's what if that's the way you're going to build this analogy or where you're going with the word threat.
To be honest, I'm not entirely sure I understand what you're asking me. I intend to address the points that you've raised.
You're talking about threat.
Yes.
And you're saying you talked about the dictionary, the normal understanding of what a threat is. And I just was asking you whether you were going to add something that that was missing as far as what the jury could...
I see. Yes. Yes, I do plan to add something. And I think the state and I and the Court of Appeals are in agreement on what should be added. Here would be the way that I would paraphrase or summarize the definition of a threat for First Amendment purposes. A threat is a communication, either by words or acts, that would be interpreted by a reasonable person under the totality of the circumstances as a serious expression of present intent to harm another person.
Say that again, would you please?
Yes, and I actually didn't finish yet either. A communication, either by words or acts, or both, that would be interpreted by a reasonable person under the totality of circumstances as a serious expression of present intent to harm another person, either at once or in the future. And here, Justice Wilcox, is what I'm adding. But not including just the mere hope, wish, or desire to harm another, or even the crudest and most offensive statements of political disapproval. I believe what needs to be added to the common and ordinary dictionary definition of threat is the type of thing that the United States Supreme Court said in Watts versus United States is not contemplated by the Constitution. Hyperbole, exaggeration, idle or careless criticism. Those are the kinds of things that I think need to be added to bring the definition into a constitutional conformity. Because what Watts stands for is that the First Amendment does protect hyperbolic criticism, even if it is crude and vigorous when it is directed against government officials.
Would it then be a jury decision as to whether the facts are sufficient to meet that definition, if that were in the jury instruction?
It's both a jury question and a question to be determined on appeal. That's going to come around to the standard of review, more or less, in terms of the sufficiency, so let me address that briefly. Yes, the jury does determine in the first instance whether a real or genuine threat was uttered based upon its determinations of credibility, inferences, the weight of the evidence, and so forth. Of course, the jury did not make that determination in this particular case, if I'm correct that the pattern jury instruction was inadequate.
Counsel, when the case was argued before the jury, was it argued that this was hyperbole or jest by the defendant?
I believe the defense did argue to a certain degree that these were not, the defense statements were not intended as genuine threats to shoot the judge, yes. I think the lawyers, both of the lawyers, the prosecutor and the defense lawyer, did make that argument. I don't think that's good enough, though, because the defendant was entitled to have the jury instructed as a matter of law that the jury could not convict if it found it to be hyperbole or jest.
Well, I know you're going to get to the instruction later in your argument, but I'm sure you're going to be talking then about, and the other side will as well, about whether or not the instruction about intentional threat is broad enough to cover what you're now telling us.
Yes, that's correct. So this in part is a jury question, but in part it is also a question for the court. Now, I have to confess, in all candor, I'm somewhat embarrassed to stand before the Supreme Court and admit that my Court of Appeals brief did not include the Wisconsin test for appellate review of questions of constitutional fact, as originally explained in State versus Woods and more recently discussed in State versus Phillips, which is cited in my brief. But nevertheless, I think Wisconsin does have a relatively well-settled test that issues of constitutional fact are to be reviewed de novo on appeal. Matters of historical fact are treated with deference unless they're clearly erroneous. And I submit that whether Mr. Perkins' words were a true threat is a matter of constitutional fact. And I bolster that with the analysis I did of how obscenity cases are reviewed in the appellate courts. I think I've showed in my written brief that the court does do some independent review of whether allegedly obscene material is in fact obscene. And I don't think there should be a different standard that should apply for whether a threat is a true threat. So then, that is my proposed definition of what a threat really is, consistent with the First Amendment. And at this point, I would like to briefly review the sufficiency of the evidence and the reasons why I think the Court of Appeals went astray in the way it treated this issue. The bottom line is I think that Mr. Perkins' words were too equivocal, too hypothetical in this particular case under all of the circumstances to show that he had a present intent to commit suicide. And it follows from that that they are also too equivocal and hypothetical to show that he had a present intent to shoot Judge Radcliffe. And that, in fact, viewed as a whole, I think the situation establishes that what Mr. Perkins was really trying to say is that he did not have a present intent either to kill himself or to shoot Judge Radcliffe. Although he certainly did crudely express his disapproval of the judge. Here are the factors that I think are important. First of all, we know that before the police officer arrived at Mr. Perkins' home, Mr. Perkins had never mentioned Judd Radcliffe in any way, shape, or form to any of the people he had been talking with. Not the child support workers at the courthouse, not the bartender where he had spent the afternoon, not his sister-in-law, or the friend who called him on the telephone.
What difference does that make? I mean, you're saying that he had to mention to several people that he was going to shoot the judge when you look at the sequence of events, and we ask, isn't this a, we understand it's a jury question, credibility and credible evidence. What are you saying that unless you make several statements that you're going to do away with somebody, or you look at it, you're saying the totality, and in the totality of the situation, you have to say more than once or to certain people that you're...
No, I'm not suggesting the hard and fast rule that it has to be said more than once. But I do think it's a relevant factor that if it came up as a brief, isolated incident that wasn't really germane to the subject matter, that it's more likely to be a careless remark rather than an intentional one. Also, before the police officer arrived, Mr. Perkins had utilized sarcasm in discussing his state of mind with his sister-in-law. She called and said she had heard a bang, and he said, "Well, I haven't killed myself yet," and he laughed. Now, again, that in and of itself doesn't prove it wasn't a true threat, but I think it's relevant. Now the situation is going to change because his sister-in-law, Peggy, comes over to the house and visits with him in person. At that point, Mr. Perkins says that he would call the police before he kills himself so that his body could be removed before his parents returned home. Again, I think there's an element of sarcasm there. And Peggy testified that she discussed with him about going to a hospital. The reason was, and this is what she testified to, that from meeting with him and listening to what he said, she thought he wanted somebody to help him. Now the officer calls, talks with Peggy, and by the way, Peggy tells the officer that Morrow had not mentioned anything about harming himself for the past half an hour. Nevertheless, the officer comes over, and what Mr. Perkins says is that he had fired a gun in the hope that someone would come and talk with him. Again, that parallels Peggy's impression that she thought Mr. Perkins wanted help. Morrow said that he did not have a specific plan to commit suicide, although he was thinking about it. And when the officer questioned him over and over for the course of almost 30 minutes, Morrow told the officer that if he were going to commit suicide, he would use a shoestring, and he grinned. Again, that in and of itself doesn't make or break the case, but I think it's important. Finally, after this 30 minutes of talk back and forth, Morrow makes the statement that if I were going to kill myself, I would shoot Judge Radcliffe first, and then he proceeds with the epithet. I suggest to you that at that point, and we must remember, there's two officers there, as well as the sister-in-law, Peggy. So there's four of them sitting around the living room. And the officer still doesn't immediately react. He talks a while longer and then takes Morrow into protective custody. So in terms of how the Court of Appeals addressed these factors, they looked at four different issues. They looked at whether Morrow had a motive against Judge Radcliffe. And as I've indicated in my brief, I don't know where that gets us. Mr. Watts certainly had a motive against President Johnson as well, and that didn't change the outcome there. And I would like to suggest that motive is inherently ambiguous in a sense, at least with respect to what's a true threat and what isn't. Because the motive gives you a reason to make a true threat, perhaps, but it equally gives a reason merely to exercise your right of badmouthing somebody. And how do you tell the difference? I mean, a jury is not entitled to speculate there. The Court of Appeals also looked to the fact that this was not in a public political demonstration. But I suggest that the First Amendment protects equally in private places. And neither Watts' comment nor, I think, Perkins are changed in their character, whether they're stated publicly or privately.
Counsel, could I ask a question? If you were going over the facts point by point, I felt as though I were sitting in the jury box and you were re-arguing the case. Tell me once again why all those specific arguments are important here. I mean, after all, a jury must have heard arguments like that or similar arguments and found otherwise.
My position, Your Honor, is that this court must independently review and confirm or disconfirm whether the facts that the jury convicted upon meet the constitutional standard of a true threat. The United States Supreme Court in Watts did look to the public nature of the forum. They did look to whether Mr. Watts' words were conditional or equivocal. They did look to the reaction of the audience. So if the United States Supreme Court did it, I think what they were actually doing in Watts, even though they didn't say that, is applying the Wisconsin standard of de novo review for issues of constitutional fact.
All right, then, counsel, if we go that way, in Watts, there was no gun. Here, there was a gun. In Watts, there was no weapon. In Watts, there was no firing of a weapon. Here, allegedly, there was a firing of a weapon from the lips of the from your client. Now, is that important?
I think it's a factor that can be taken into consideration.
This is the way you're asking us to take a look, and I'm just asking that those are, in my opinion, significant differences between Watts and this case.
It's part of the totality of circumstances, certainly. just as the fact that the guns were locked up and that Merle didn't have a key to them. That's undisputed testimony.
Well, in other words, you're saying that we do not use the standard what is the standard in a regular criminal case with a jury on reviewing the verdict?
Well, in Bollinger, this court set out a test whereby the question to be asked is whether under any, there's any reasonable view under which the jury could resolve the evidence in terms of weight, credibility, and the inference that's not consistent with the presumption of innocence. And I am suggesting that is not the standard for this court to apply.
Can you give us any case in which you have a situation that we use this de novo review in effect, which means a lot less deference than the jury verdict? What about in a defamation case? Is defamation involved, First Amendment?
I hadn't really thought about that. I don't think there should be analytically, though, any difference between a civil or a criminal case if the conduct that's brought before the court as a basis for the cause of action is arguably protected by the First Amendment. Then I think on appeal, if you're looking at the sufficiency to establish the cause of action, the court has a duty to review matters of constitutional fact independently.
Okay, that was the closest thing I could think of, First Amendment, but if there's something else in criminal law that you have as authority for this different kind of view of review.
Well, my written brief cited a number of cases, both in Wisconsin and in the United States Supreme Court.
You have to stand in front of the microphone. Okay.
I apologize.
Dealing with obscenity?
I have cited in my written brief a number of cases dealing with the law of obscenity.
So a determination of what's obscene would be reviewed de novo?
In the limited sense of determining, as a matter of constitutional fact, whether the material is obscene. Not to review all the historical facts or questions of credibility.
This is after a jury verdict, not a directed verdict.
Yes. Okay. The last point that I wanted to make about the Court of Appeals decision about the sufficiency of the evidence is that I think is factually inaccurate. The Court of Appeals said, and I'm quoting, "Those who had been in contact with Perkins immediately prior to the threat believed him to be intent on killing himself," end quote. I don't think the facts support that. Peggy said that she felt much better and wasn't so concerned after she came over and talked to Merle. It took the officer 30 minutes to decide whether to take him into protective custody. I think the situation is much more equivocal, and uncertain than the Court of Appeals made it sound. With respect to the jury instruction, I'd like to indicate that the reason why I think the jury instruction is inadequate is because it gives no definition of a threat, none at all. And therefore, this court has no way of knowing whether the jury may have utilized a common and ordinary definition and therefore may have stepped on Mr. Perkins' right to exercise hyperbole in his speech. In fact, we have no idea what standards the jury applied. And it's true that there is a separate element of specific intent for the Wisconsin crime, that the threat must have been made intentionally, but I respectfully suggest that just begs the question. If we don't know what a threat is, then making the threat intentionally doesn't tell us anything more. We don't live in an ideal world where jurors have the discrimination of appellate judges and appellate lawyers or semanticists. You know, and I kind of think I know what the jury instruction committee was thinking about when they wrote this up, but I'm a professional appellate lawyer, and I just don't think that the jury instruction as it stands is adequate.
Was there a supplemental requested?
No. there was no objection or request for any additional instruction. So I'm bringing this issue to you solely as an interest of justice request for discretionary relief.
Other than to indicate to us that there's no definition of threat in the instruction, how else would you alter the instruction?
I think the key points, and I would refer you generally to page 14 of the appellant's brief. I've quoted U.S. District Judge Leonard Sands' proposed federal instruction defining a threat. I think it ought to say a serious expression of present intent, but not including hyperbole, exaggeration, and so forth. In other words, I would add that it should be a serious expression that's communication, and that it refers to present intent. It doesn't make any sense to talk about, well, I wanted to strangle you last week. That isn't a threat. Or, you know, maybe next week I'm going to want to harm you. That isn't a threat either. What we're talking about is present intent. But not, and here's the key, again, that I add, it must contain language, but not hyperbole and so forth, as referred to in Watts. I run out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Attorney Balestrieri, representing the state.
Thank you, Your Honor. The public defender and I disagree about many things in this case, and as it turns out in this oral argument, we disagree about one more. As a general proposition, I think I would agree with the public defender's definition of a threat and what constitutes a serious threat. But I take exception to one part of his definition when he speaks about a present intent. It sounds to me like what he's saying is that in order for there to be a serious threat, the person who utters the words in question must have an actual subjective intent to harm. And I disagree with that proposition. I don't think that's true. It certainly is not true from a reading of the statute. It is not true from a reading of any of the cases that talk about what constitutes the kind of threat which will qualify for a threat under the First Amendment. It gets a little confusing because under the Wisconsin statute, there are actually two expressions of intent. The defendant must certainly have an intent to utter a remark. That's absolutely clear, and that is a subjective intent. But then, what kind of a remark must he utter? It must be a remark which expresses an intent to injure. You read that statute, and what that statute means is he doesn't actually have to have a subjective intent to injure. He just has to utter a remark which expresses an intent to injure. This is like the old second-degree murder statute, the old depraved mind murder statute, where the state had to prove that the defendant committed acts which evinced a depraved mind. The state did not have to prove that the defendant actually had the depraved mind, only that he committed acts which evinced a depraved mind. And it's the same kind of a situation here.
Counsel, does that mean then that, it seems to me you're saying, if he utters it, regardless of his intent, is that what you're...
Well, as I said, there are two intents, which is why it's kind of confusing here.
Would a reasonable person interpret the speech to be a threat as opposed to hyperbole or jest? Is that a definition that you would accept?
Yes. We both agree that this is an objective test, that the question is not what any particular person, not what the person threatened might think, not necessarily what the threatener might think. It's a question of how would a reasonable person view these words under all of the circumstances in which they were uttered. We absolutely agree on that. No question.
Okay, so we have an intent to utter. Is there any question about his having an intent to utter here, the subjective intent that you say?
Well, that's one of the factual issues that has to be resolved by the jury in the case.
All right. And the second one, you says, expresses an intent to injure. That's the second intent.
That's the second part of it.
Okay, so...
And in terms of expressing an intent to injure, you kind of look at the words themselves, and again, you look at the circumstances to see whether or not what he is saying is, I intend to injure the judge.
And is that where you put in hyperbole and jest? Is that where you put in the objective standard?
The objective standard applies across the board here.
Okay, so what about intent to utter? You said that was subjective.
That part of it is subjective. Okay. The jury must find that the defendant, in fact, intended to make a statement that, and this is getting a little confusing here because we're stringing this out, but the jury must find that the defendant had a subjective intent to utter a statement which objectively a reasonable person would determine articulates as a threat.
So even if the utterer, the person making the statement, had no real intent to harm, he could still be found guilty of this because he intended to make the statement.
Absolutely. The crime here, this is not an inchoate crime. This is not an attempt to kill a judge. This is not solicitation to kill a judge or conspiracy to solicit a judge. The crime here is the words that are spoken. The crime here is essentially a crime of intimidation. Okay. It's speaking words that cause the listener to become intimidated and fearful. That's the gist of the offense here.
Give me an example where somebody does not have a subjective intent to make a statement.
Watts is the clear example of that, I think, where the U.S. Supreme Court held that Watts' intent was only to make a statement which was political hyperbole, objectively under the
circumstances.
But there,
objectively, a reasonable person would have thought also that it was hyperbole.
Right.
So where does it come under?
I'm sorry,
I don't understand how you can not have a subjective intent to make a statement.
Well, it's not just a subjective intent to make a statement. It's a subjective intent to make a particular kind of statement, namely a kind of statement that a reasonable person would view as a threat.
So I have to have a subjective intent when I say something to you that you will take me seriously.
Yes, I think that pretty much accurately describes it.
And if I have that intent that you take me seriously, and you, as a reasonable person, would take me seriously, that constitutes the offense.
Yes.
So here, you say a jury is going to did find that there was a subjective intent to make the statement that could be objectively relied upon, and that the jury also found that this was a threat. Objectively.
Yes, that's what the jury was instructed to find, and since they came back with a verdict of guilty, I think we have to assume they made that finding.
Then the jury instruction is flawed because it doesn't contain the objective part of the test, right?
Well, no, I think the jury instruction is not flawed. I think the jury instruction, although it could be better, I'm not saying that this is a great instruction, and I have no doubt that after this case is decided, the Jury Instructions Committee is going to do some tinkering. But I think it is adequate to, I think the jury instruction is adequate to express that concept, that this is a situation in which there must be at least a serious threat. That is, the defendant must have intended to make a statement which is going to be viewed objectively as a threat.
But it speaks only to the subjective intent of the defendant. It doesn't say anything about the objective effect of the words and how.
No, it does not. It does. No, you're right. It doesn't say. It doesn't say anything about objective or subjective. But it's just the fact that the defendant has to have this purpose to communicate a threat. And we all agree that there is a common definition of threat, which most people would understand, that that because the defendant has to have this intent to communicate what we all would understand as a threat, that in and of itself is adequate to communicate to the jury that they have to make the kind of finding which is necessary under the First Amendment, namely that this is a serious threat. And in this context, since you've asked this question at this point, I would like to emphasize that the issue in this case is not whether this jury instruction is good or bad. The defendant waived any right to make any complaint about that instruction. So the question that we're facing here is whether or not this case was fully tried under the total facts of what went on here. And we have to look to determine that, not only at the jury instruction, but at all of the other things that would provide indicia of whether the real issue was presented to the jury and whether the jury decided the real issue as opposed to some collateral issue or some issue which isn't even presented by the law.
But if there's a fundamental flaw in the jury instruction under First Amendment jurisprudence, doesn't that establish that proposition?
Not necessarily. First of all, I don't agree that there was a flaw. And secondly, even if there was a flaw, I don't think that is necessarily conclusive. If in fact, the case is presented to the jury in such a way that they know what they are supposed to find, what the real point of dispute was. And here it was very clear to the jury what the real point of dispute was. The state was arguing that this was a serious threat. Perkins was arguing that this was not a serious threat. To use his word, he said this was just a, quote, hypothetical. I didn't really mean this as a threat.
Sure, I understand that the whole thrust of the defense was he didn't really mean it.
Right. So the jury was made well aware of what the real issue in this case was. The real issue was this a serious threat? That's the issue. That was the issue that was presented. That was the issue that was tried. And the jury was well aware that that was the issue. That was what they had to decide. There was never any question that a threat was, that words which articulated a threat were made. I mean, Perkins never denied that he said, I'm going to kill Judge Radcliffe. He never denied that. He admitted that.
Why don't we look at the jury instructions?
I'm sorry?
What Perkins was saying is that even though I said it, I was saying it in jest, hyperbole, I was laughing at the time I said this.
Hypothetically, to use the precise word that he used in his defense. And that was the issue. Is this a real threat or is this a hypothetical threat?
Let's look at the jury instructions.
Okay.
It says the first element requires that the defendant threatened to cause bodily harm to the victim. Then it goes on that the victim is a judge, that the defendant knows he's a judge, and that the victim has a consent to be threatened. Okay? I'm up to the sixth element, but maybe that's not where I should be. Okay?
Okay.
Sixth element says the sixth element requires that the defendant acted intentionally. This requires that the defendant acted with the mental purpose to threaten bodily harm to another human being. Then it goes on to the usual language about a person's intent. You can't look into the mind. You may determine such intent directly or indirectly. You may consider any statements or conduct which indicate the state of mind. You may find intent to threaten bodily harm from such statements or conduct. But you're not required to do so. You are the sole judge of the facts, and you must not find the defendant guilty unless you are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intended to threaten bodily harm. And I don't see anything else that affects this. So it seems to me, and I think you're right, this was not objected to, so if the court considers it, it either considers it under the discretionary justice standard or considers it that it's going to not hold the waiver against the party, which we do, as you know, and we reach the issues. So it seems to me that under the first element and the sixth element, The jury is only instructed to determine the defendant's subjective intent to make a statement. It never tells the jury that what do you think as a reasonable person, is this a real threat, or is it hyperbole, or he's talking out of his drink and he's talking out of his mental illness or whatever his problems are at the moment. Never says that.
Well, to the extent that that may be a flaw in the instruction, it's a flaw which actually favors the defendant, because if the jury was required to actually find that the defendant had a subjective intent to injure, that's a much tougher standard.
No, it's to threaten. Acted with a mental purpose to threaten. Isn't that what we're talking about here? Because he didn't do anything. To threaten.
Yes, and what that means is that what the jury was instructed is that they had to determine whether, when Perkins uttered his remark about killing Judge Radcliffe, he uttered it for the purpose of expressing an intent to kill or inflict harm on Judge Radcliffe. Now, you're right. There is nothing in this instruction that says this is objective. You're
right.
Absolutely correct.
That's right.
So I can't read that into the instruction. It's not there.
And it should have been there.
It would have been better if it would have been there. I'll put it that way.
That for the moment.
I'll put it that way.
All right. And you just think it's good enough then that it's not in the instructions. You agree that in the First Amendment requires that kind of concept? That is, that it's be an objective test of a reasonable person, and that hyperbole, hope, wish, jest, etc., are protected?
Yes, I agree with that.
Well, that's a concession that it's got to be in the jury instruction, because if we have a statute which criminalizes speech and a prosecution under that statute, isn't that looked at in a whole different sort of way? And if your position is that, yeah, that's what's required under the First Amendment, then it's got to be the instruction, doesn't it? Otherwise...
Well, let me put it this way. Let me backtrack a little bit. I won't say that an objective standard, maybe it's not accurate to say that an objective standard is required by the First Amendment.
Reasonable person standard.
The reasonable person standard.
How does that differ from the objective?
It's the same thing. I won't say it's required by the First Amendment. I will say that generally under First Amendment jurisprudence, that's the way it's viewed. But I will say this, that is an easier standard for the prosecution to meet than a standard which would require the prosecution to prove a subjective intent on the part of the defendant to actually commit the injury. So if this instruction is flawed in that respect, it's flawed in favor of the defendant.
No, I think you're misreading the instruction. The intent element as described in the instruction doesn't speak to the presence of an actual intent to carry out the threat or an intent to kill or an intent to harm, but only an intent to threaten. So it correctly speaks to the subjective intent element of this offense without any First Amendment problem, but the First Amendment issue comes into play because the jury, because this is a statute which criminalizes speech, has to know how to evaluate the speech. Right?
And, oh, sure, of course.
And they were given no basis to do that under the law by the judge, and a closing argument doesn't substitute for jury instructions on the law from the judge. Do they?
They do, in my opinion, when the issue is...
Wait, okay.
Interest of justice.
Okay. Okay, so it's a waiver, you know...
Well, it depends on, you know, it depends on what the issue is and what your standard of review is. And I maintain quite adamantly that your standard is not a review of the instruction per se, but it's an instruction of whether the jury in this case, rightly or wrongly, decided the real point of contest between the two parties. And I think they did.
Does the standard of review, do you agree with your opposing counsel that this represents a constitutional fact
Oh, absolutely not.
Which the court applies a two-step standard of review, a la State versus Martwood?
No, I totally disagree with that. And I have cited to you cases that are specifically on point that that say that whether a threat is a serious threat is a pure question of fact, not a mixed question of fact and law. And I have cited to you cases that say that in reviewing whether the evidence is sufficient to show a serious threat, you review that the way you review any other finding of fact. Namely, you give deference to the jury, and if any reasonable person could have made that determination, you affirm.
Counsel, are you using serious threat to be synonymous with the term of art, true threat?
I'm not sure whether they're synonymous or not. I think a serious threat constitutes the kind of thing that both of us have been talking about, except for the one point of difference that I made. It is an intentional expression of an intent to harm. That's what I consider a true threat or a serious threat, or the kind of threat that we're concerned with under the First Amendment.
Okay.
That would be taken seriously by a reasonable person.
A threat that would be taken seriously by a reasonable person. That's what I consider a serious threat or a true threat.
I mean, the term true threat has a laundry list of First Amendment cases interpreting it. I mean, as opposed to, and an element of that might be, you know, and I really mean it, I take me seriously. But, I mean, it seems to me that, and correct me, I mean this, it seems to me that you're using the word serious threat interchangeably with the constitutional, with the term that we use in describing the constitutional issue of true threat.
We're talking about the constitutional issue here. We're talking about what attributes the threat must have in order to be punishable under the First Amendment. And I think the distinction, as both counsel have pointed out, the distinction is whether this is a serious or a true or a real, whatever kind of descriptive word you might want to apply, but whether this expresses a whether it's an expression of a real intent to injure, or whether, on the other hand, it's just some kind of joke or hyperbole or whatever you want to call it that distinguishes it from being a real expression of an intent to harm. You're not really intending to harm. You are intending to harm. That's the distinction, or expressing this intent to harm.
Could you apply your analysis here to the phenomenon of bomb threats?
Oh, this would, yeah, this would apply. This would apply to any kind of a threat, not just a threat. The First Amendment applies to any kind of threat across the board, regardless of whether it's a threat to harm the judge or kill the president or to bomb the state office building or whatever. I mean, it applies in all those contexts. So what you'd have to do if a person called in to make a bomb threat would be to determine whether at the time the threat was called in, the person had a serious, genuine intent to utter words which a reasonable person would interpret as a serious threat to set off the bomb. Now, he doesn't actually have to have, and I stress this, he doesn't actually have to have the intent to place a bomb in the building or to set off that bomb. He just has to give the impression that people would take seriously that he has such intent. I mean, often, I'm glad you asked this question, because in the context of bomb threats, we know that very few of them, in fact, almost none of them, are cases in which there is actually a bomb planted. What the person does when he makes the threat is he just wants to disrupt something. He calls in, and we had a bunch of these at MATC for a couple of years ago. There was a whole series of them. And what the person wanted to do was just disrupt classes. There was no actual intent to set off the bomb, but what the person did when he called in the bomb threat was the whole place got evacuated, the police got called in, there was a big search for a bomb, and there was just a total disruption, which is what the caller really wanted to do. And those bomb threats were serious threats. They actually caught one of the persons and he got prosecuted for it. So that's where that's where the gist of the offense is. It's this idea of disrupting or intimidating someone else. It's the words that are spoken which themselves constitute the crime when they're done under the requisite circumstances.
Well, then maybe what I'm having trouble with is distinguishing the bomb threat and distinguishing your theory of the threat here with the true threat analysis that Justice Bradley talked about. When do you apply one and when do you apply the other? Or are they the same thing? Or
I think we are all talking about the same thing. I think we're all on the same page. We're all on the same page of the dictionary. We're just reading slightly different definitions. But I think we're all talking about the same thing, regardless of what the specific context of the threat is. I think we're all talking about a requirement that this be something that the defendant really means to be a threat, as opposed to something the defendant doesn't mean to be a threat. He means to be something else. He means to be a joke or whatever.
But Mr. Schmall wouldn't argue, if we had a bomb threat case, would he, that the person making the call or writing the note actually intended to blow up the school, and if he didn't, or she didn't, the person couldn't be prosecuted.
Well, I don't know. I, under his definition, where he says that there has to be this present threat, I can't speak for Mr. Schmall. Perhaps you've got to ask him the question. But as I interpret his definition, where he inserts this critical word present that I disagree with, I think he would argue that in the context of a bomb threat, there would actually have to be a subjective intent to set off a bomb.
Okay, well, let's say I have a mental illness, or I've had a few too many to drink. I'm not too happy with the judge. I say I'm going to kill Judge Radcliffe with my cigarette. Or I'm going to blow up the building with my cigarette. I have a subjective intent to make a statement, but no reasonable person thinks I'm going to be successful or that I really can be serious when I think I'm going to blow up the building with my cigarette or kill him with my cigarette. How does that fit into this? And I'm on your page 9 of your brief. Thus, the jury was told they had to determine whether Perkins uttered his remark about killing Radcliffe for the purpose of expressing an intent to inflict bodily harm on the judge. Well, I did. I uttered it for the purpose of expressing my intent to inflict bodily harm on him. And when someone not only uses words but expresses an intent to inflict harm, but utters those words with the purpose of communicating that intent, he is making a serious threat. And that's what you say. The jury was alerted, therefore, that they should not convict Perkins if his purpose was only to make a joke or to express political hyperbole, if his comment was simply idle or careless talk made without purpose, or if his comment was merely hypothetical. They could only convict if the threat was meant to be serious. So what about my cigarette?
Well, under your cigarette case, no one would take that as a serious threat.
No, but the jury wasn't told that. accuracy. That's my problem with this. I mean, I agree, Norm, that no reasonably objective purpose would a person would think that I have the intent to harm. But the jury was told, as the first paragraph I read says, that it was uttered and that I had a subjective intent, which I did. But your next paragraph is the one that bothers me, because it says the jury was alerted that if my purpose was a joke or I wasn't meant to be serious, etc.
Right, and I think
the jury was alerted. That's my problem.
I think the jury was reasonably alerted to that when they were told that in order to convict Perkins, he had to have acted with the mental purpose to threaten bodily harm. That had to be his purpose, that he had to have the purpose to threaten bodily harm as opposed to a purpose to make a joke, as opposed to a purpose to engage in political hyperbole, as opposed to a purpose to engage in anything else other than this serious threat. Now, I will say this again, that the jury, the whole concept of what constitutes a serious threat could have been explained better. I am not trying to defend this as a wonderful instruction. I'm not that dumb. But what I'm saying is that at least in the context of this trial, the whole context of this trial, this instruction, together with the testimony of the defendant and the arguments of both attorneys, all of which focused on the whole question of was this a serious threat or was this just a hypothetical threat, that the real issue under the circumstances of this case was fully tried. Now, maybe I would have to concede in some other case where there was nothing but this jury instruction, that maybe the case wasn't fully tried. Maybe the jury did not focus on that issue of serious versus hyperbole. But I don't have to make that concession here.
But what about, Mr. Ballastieri, a case where it's an absurdity that what the defendant is threatening just can't happen? I'm going to kill the judge by sending out rays from my fingertips that will pierce through his body. Okay, the defendant, I intended to make that statement. I intended to make it a threatening statement. But no reasonable person could expect bodily harm from that. Now, don't you think the jury has to be told that?
I think they should be told that.
But even under your definition of what a true threat is, and you agreed with the counsel, under the totality of the, interpreted by a reasonable person, under the totality of the circumstances, as a serious expression of present intent to harm another.
And I disagree with the word present, by the way.
Okay, intent to harm another. Now, if you said that, I'd say, hey, you know, hit the road, Jack. I wouldn't be scared by that. I wouldn't perceive that as maybe you think you can do it, but I'm not going to have any fear whatsoever of my own safety.
You don't know my capabilities.
Well, do you need the fear element?
I'm sorry, Judge?
Do you need the fear? I mean, maybe Radcliffe didn't even know about this.
No, fear is not an element here. Actual fear is not an element. No.
And is it is
my example is any reasonable
right.
person.
And it was kind of thing I was trying to do, although this is a better example with my cigarette. No, you know I'm not going to be able to blow up that building with a cigarette. I guess if it had gas in it, I might be able to, but barring that, I can't. I can't kill them with my cigarette. So do you call that a serious threat?
Well, no, you're not.
Aside from this case.
No, your example is obviously...
You take him into the emergency ward to check him out, which is what the police officer did here.
Yeah, because because he thought it was a serious threat. at least the part where he was going to kill himself was a serious threat.
Right. That's right. That he thought was serious.
Mr. Bellisari, just, I've seen your brief. What about the ineffective or effective assistance of counsel argument where they mentioned the prior, you know, the prior offenses because of the first charge? It was a person who had been convicted and he had these weapons. What? The argument is made by opposing counsel that this really should not have been allowed. What do you think? What's the state's position on that third argument as far as the denied effective assistance of counsel?
Well, our position is that he hasn't proved prejudice.
And it wasn't, that would be brought out in the normal course. In other words, it would have been that they heard about it, they actually found him not guilty of those.
Well, yeah, I think this is one case where that old legal axiom, the proof of the pudding is in the eating, absolutely applies, because the jury, there were actually three charges in two categories. One was use of a weapon, and the other one was the threat. The jury was informed that the defendant had been convicted of armed robbery. So they knew from that information that the defendant had on a previous occasion possessed and used a weapon. They could have very easily convicted him of the crimes involving possession and use of a weapon in this case based on the other act's evidence, but they did not. And the fact that they did not use the other act's evidence to convict him of some of the crimes in this case raises an inference that they did not use the other act's evidence to convict him of the crime of threatening a judge. Juries are presumed to act reasonably, and especially in ineffective assistance of counsel cases. And it would have been totally unreasonable for them to acquit in the one instance and yet use the other act's evidence to convict in the other instance. My time is up. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Bellisari. Mr. Small, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. I just have a few comments that are more in the nature of clarification rather than refuting anything that the Attorney General has said. To clarify at the beginning, I categorically do not contend that a true threat conveys an intention to carry out the actual harm. Indeed, I did not contend that a person must even evince the ability to carry out his threat. For example, one of my former clients serving a life term were to say to me, Bill, you lost my appeal. I don't know if I'm ever going to get paroled, but if I do, I'm going to find you and hunt you down and do you bad. I think that potentially could be a true threat.
Except there isn't any statute that makes it a crime to threaten a public defender, I don't think.
That's true.
I'm sorry to tell you that, but I don't
believe it. That's all right. Just you know how to protect yourself.
Become a judge.
Become a judge.
For that reason, Mr. Justice Prosser, I personally don't like the term true threat because it somehow conveys or connotes the actual carrying out. I think a better term would be a real threat or a genuine threat or a serious threat, as the Attorney General has indicated. But the Supreme Court used the term true threat, and that's why I used it. Also, I do not contend that in order for it to be a true threat, it must actually induce fear in the victim. And after listening to the Attorney General, I don't think we really dispute what a true threat is, but there was a little element of confusion, and I want to address it. I think the intent that the Wisconsin jury instruction has in element number 6 is more than just an intent to utter words. It's an intent that the words you utter be taken as a serious threat by a reasonable person.
So, in essence, if you were writing this, you would say that there's two factors that they must find. First, that he did intend to utter the words. And secondly, he must have intended that the words be taken seriously.
I think so. And then if we add in what my definition was or whatever definition you choose as to what a true threat is.
Isn't that it? To cause harm to another now or in the future?
But not including the hyperbole, exaggeration, and so on and so forth. Okay.
Well, it almost seems to me that is included when you say that it must cause in the mind of a reasonable person the concern.
Well,
that this is a serious expression. Isn't that sort of, I guess maybe I could add it in, but isn't that somewhat superfluous?
It could be, but it might not be. And here I can distinguish, I think, the examples that your honors were given about killing someone with a cigarette or with the rays from your fingers. Supposing I sit down with a bunch of friends to play poker, and I say at the beginning of the session, I'm going to skin you alive tonight, chump. I'm going to carve you up into little pieces and eat the eyeballs for breakfast. Now, on the face of it, that's a threat to do harm. And it's only because of the context, I mean, that even a reasonable person would take as an expression of intent to do harm. But for the context, they know me, that they know this is just a card playing, you know, a trash talk. lastly, the ineffective assistance issue didn't really come up much, but I did want to call the court's attention to a case that I transmitted in a letter to the court, Malkovich versus State. I believe that supports the defendant's argument that there is a big difference in terms of prejudice between whether the jury is merely informed that a person has prior convictions, even prior felony convictions, and the nature of the convictions, at least where the nature, as here, is crimes of robbery or armed robbery that I think in a common sense way imply that the person has a character to threaten other people. That's all I have, unless there are any additional questions. Thank you.
There are none. That concludes our argument on 99-1924 CR, State v. Perkins. Thank you, counsel. We're in recess until 9:45 on Monday.